Hi, I'm Holly.
And I'm Haley.
Welcome to Mountain Mysteries, Tales from Appalachia. Welcome back, everybody. I just wanted to let you know for episode 50, we are doing a special tribute for the 20th anniversary of 9/11. This episode is dedicated to the 2,977 lives lost that day, their family, friends, and the countless others who bear the trauma by witnessing the events of that day firsthand. This is for you all. So, it's been 20 years since that day, and it actually changed the world. I don't know, Haley, how much you remember pre-9/11.
I don't remember anything. I was four. So my mom's told me several times, I was either at preschool or I was home from preschool. But my mom remembers seeing it on, like, she watched it on TV. I think my dad was at work. I can't remember.
I was in my late teens.
Let's say you were in, like, were you in high school?
I was a senior year in high school. I was 17.
Oh my gosh.
And I was homesick that day. And yes, it was the first day of school I'd missed. And my mom woke me up, you know, and said, "Hey, are you seeing what's on the TV?" And I'm like, "What? Huh?" You know, and she was like, "A plane flew into the World Trade Center." I was like, "What the heck?" And so we started watching it. And, you know, it's interesting. As I was watching it unfold on live television, I was watching ABC News. What stood out to me is that, you know, there's a live camera capturing it. And people were jumping.
Yeah.
I was watching human beings on live television making a choice of, do I die by fire or do I jump to my death? I can't even imagine. I can't even imagine. And this is definitely a more serious episode. Just know that, you know, sometimes we have a lot more lighthearted. We talk about murder, so I don't know how lighthearted that
with
is.
Murder. But, you know, we try to bring an element of, I don't want to say humor, but an element of, there's a detachment for us, I think, and both of us working in fields that are really traumatic. And
you have to kind of compartmentalize.
Being around, you know, I mean, my parents work pretty traumatic jobs. I've grown up around that. You just develop this dark sense of humor very quickly, or you don't make it in these fields.
Yeah.
So I think this episode probably won't have as much of that.
Absolutely.
But
the biggest of which, you know, I recognize that we're definitely getting out of Appalachia a little bit. Certainly, even though New York falls within Appalachia, the state does.
Yeah, that part of the state.
I did want to do this episode because this will air on September 9th. 2 days before the 20th anniversary. And I thought that it was fitting. I thought that this was a way to tell maybe a story that you haven't heard or you wanted to hear again. And just a little bit more about that day for those who lost loved ones and those who are still carrying the scars.
Have you been to the
I have site? Not. Have you?
I've been several times. The first time I went, it was before the memorial was built. So it was still the holes in the ground.
Wow.
So that was really surreal. It was the first time I went to New York, I think it was 14, and seeing that, just the heaviness of it, like, you can't describe what it feels like to be there and to see that, and it's the only quiet place in New York, I think. Because it's so loud everywhere else. But there is a level of, you know, just mutual respect in that space, which is really interesting to see. And then I've been back several times. And then when I lived in New York, there was a they're always doing like new things at the site, because even 20 years later, there's still damage and, you know, they're still rebuilding things.
Yes.
So it's, I would go down there every once in a while if I had a free day. There's, you know, a couple of really great museums down there. If you've never been to the 9/11 Museum in, like, on Ground Zero, I would definitely recommend going, because it's, I mean, obviously the most comprehensive, like, telling of that day.
Absolutely.
But the way that they have it laid out and the way they've done it is really, really neat.
It's on my bucket list.
We'll have to go.
Definitely.
It's up there with ones where I've been a couple of times, and I think the last time I went up with a group of students, I didn't go back in, mm-hmm. because it's just, it's very heavy.
Absolutely.
It's kind of like, you could do that. That's the only thing you can do that day.
Yeah.
Because if you take the time and really take it in, and it's, yeah, it's a lot to take in.
It is a way, you know, as it should be.
Yeah. Okay. And it's beautifully done. Yeah, just being in that space is really, and it's open now. Like, you can kind of, like, just the flow of people can just walk through it. The first time I went, when they had the pools open, there was still a lot of, like, security you had to go through to even get into where the pools were.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it was more open the last time I went. You could kind of just walk right up to them.
Wow. And, of course, Haley's talking about the pools that are where the towers used to stand, and it actually has the names of the individuals who died.
The footprints. And on that person's birthday, they put a certain color rose in the... Because the way that the names are carved in, you can put things in them,
mm-hmm.
like a rose or a card or like something, you can stick things in there. So that was always pretty surreal to see, and that somebody keeps up with that. So I thought that was a really
amazing.
Nice tribute. There's like a certain color that they put in there on their birthdays.
That's amazing.
And it's a place for, I mean, the family to come, because, you know, for there weren't bodies. Like, these families had nothing to bury.
Yeah, and even now, they're finding human remains acres away, you know, and they're DNA testing them. And the individuals who have worked tirelessly, medical examiners, to be able to identify these friends and family, and it's incredible. So,
and we're seeing now with the firefighters and the first responders and paramedics and police and everybody else that was there that day, we're seeing the long-term health effects.
Yes, there's a lot of cancer.
We're seeing a lot of cancer in these folks, and people who were down there literally digging through, I mean, tons and tons of rubble.
Ash and debris.
Like, breathing that in, even with, you know, masks on and things like that, they were still exposed to so much stuff. So we're seeing a lot of that now 20 years later.
Definitely.
Which is,
there's so many ramifications.
Yeah, it's interesting to see the, you know, the fallout in that manner.
And because I was 17 years old at that point, yeah, I'm 37, I had lived, you know, in the world pre 9/11. We went to say goodbye to our relatives literally at the airplane. Like, they were walking up the steps of the plane, and we were right there saying bye to them. Like, you know, I mean, that's just what you did. They're just, you know, you never went through, I mean, you went through security, but it was just so, like, you didn't take your shoes off. There's so many things that changed post 9/11 that it just changed our world, you know? And yes, there was always that thought of, oh, terrorism, but I mean, it was so heightened. But I can say, in my lifetime up to that point, and in my lifetime since, I've never seen more coming together of neighbors and uniting of individuals who maybe never spoke to each other. Mm-hmm. Or there was this sense of, we're here to help. We're here to support you. It was overwhelming, and I've never felt it since. I can't say that I won't again in our country,
yeah.
I would say.
Yeah.
That, you know, it wasn't Democrats or Republicans or independent, like, we were just humans helping humans, and it was really incredible.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we kind of had that opportunity in the past year or so, and I really missed the mark in a lot of ways, on all sides. Yeah. So I hope we can, you know, reflect and maybe try to get back to some of that.
I hope so too.
It shouldn't have to take a national disaster.
Exactly.
To do that again. Unfortunately.
So I thought that we would start by just talking a little bit about that day, telling you a little bit of the timeline of information, and then I'm going to share with you a story, a specific story from individuals who survived, who were in the towers above the impact zone.
Yeah. That's crazy.
So on Tuesday, September 11th, 2001, it was a gorgeous day across the country. Americans woke up to a warm, sunshiny, late summer morning. It was an ordinary day. People were catching trains, having breakfast with their family, rushing off, grabbing coffee with friends, headed to work. No one ever expected the events that would happen next. 19 hijackers commandeered 4 planes headed cross-country with the goal of killing themselves and countless others, those on board the planes and those inside the buildings that were targeted. At 8:46 a.m., as those working in the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center were settling into their workday, typing at their desk, sending memos, answering phones, hijacked flight American Airlines 11 crashed into the North Tower between floors 93 and 99. 17 minutes later, flight 175, also an American Airlines, crashed into the South Tower between floors 77 and 85. I'll tell you all later why it's important to know these floors. Those above the impact zones were often trapped as jet fuel and flames filled their offices. Faced with the decision to die by smoke or fire or jump, some chose the latter. The image of people jumping to their deaths is forever in my memory. You see, like I mentioned, I was in my late teens and I watched this unfold on live television. It's hard to reconcile this in your head. 34 minutes after the South Tower was hit, Flight 77 crashed into the Pentagon in Washington, D.C. It was at that moment, for me personally, that I called my mom, who had limited cell phone minutes at that point, and I said, "Mom, it's a domino effect. We're under attack. What do we do?" And she said, "I don't know. I don't know what to do. Just stay home. Just stay home." I was so scared because all we could hear is, "There are more planes." By 9:45 a.m., all aircraft was ordered to land. Every aircraft in the United States was told to find the nearest airport and land. At 9:59 a.m., the South Tower collapsed in on itself. Even though they had ordered all aircraft to land, it was already too late for Flight 93, which had been hijacked over northern Ohio. The passengers fought the hijackers in order to regain control of the plane. It is believed that the passengers were told via phone about the other attacks, so they started to plan to take back the plane. According to black box recordings, they were successful in storming the cockpit and trying to take control. Unfortunately, they weren't able to maintain the altitude. The plane crashed into an open field in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. It is believed that the hijackers intended to hit the White House or the Capitol building. They saved countless lives. At 10:28 a.m., the North Tower collapsed, less than 2 hours after being struck. At 10:59, 5 stories of the Pentagon collapsed as a direct result of the intense fire. By 5:20 p.m. that night, World Trade Center 7 collapsed. In total, as I mentioned, 2,977 lives were lost that day. Those in the towers, in the Pentagon, and those in the planes. It is my hope that it's as we are approaching the 20th anniversary of that day, that we can take a moment and offer our respect and love to those who survived and those who did not. I also think a lot about the family and the friends who are left to deal with the tragedy, to think about it. And I can't imagine how they feel on this day, what they go through emotionally. So if anything, I want to offer this story today. And I debated on which story to tell because there are so many from 9/11. I wanted to tell you about the heroes of Flight 93 that took back the plane. I wanted to tell you about the two Port Authority officers who survived 13 hours trapped in the rubble when the towers collapsed. I wanted to talk about the Port Authority project manager who lost his life but saved dozens of others. Over the years, I've had countless stories that I've heard, all of them equally as heartbreaking yet encouraging. When backed against insurmountable odds, listening to stories of people helping others, strangers risking their lives to spare others, gives me hope in humanity. Most people are good. So today, in light of the 20th anniversary, I want to tell you the story of Brian Clark and Stanley Pramuth. Please note, I have never met or directly interviewed Brian and Stanley, both whom are still alive. But I am retelling their stories that have come directly from their public speakings and interviews that they have given. This story is theirs. Brian Clark worked for Euro Brokers on the 84th floor of South World Trade Center. When Flight 175 crashed into the tower, it hit between floors 77 and 85.
I think it's hard for me to imagine a building that tall.
Right?
It was until I was there and I saw the new One World Trade, which is, I believe, bigger. Like, it's taller than the other two were.
Wow.
And you can go up in there and there's like an observation deck. I've never done it. Ooh, it just makes me nervous.
Yeah.
I guess. I don't know. It's just something about it just freaks me out a little bit. But yeah, I think, especially like coming, like living in small towns and, you know, the biggest building I'd ever been in before I'd been to New York was, I don't know, like 8 stories. Probably like the hospital.
Wow.
It was probably like the biggest building I'd been in. I mean, I'd been to like Atlanta and Charlotte and places like that and seen bigger buildings, but like nothing compares.
Oh, definitely not.
Like, the idea of 70-something floors is like, what?
Well, so what's interesting is that Brian's company used to actually be on the 31st floor. Mm-hmm. But they ended up moving to the 84th. And something that was interesting is to get that high up in the building, you would have to take one elevator, go across what's called the sky lobby to the 78th floor, and then up another elevator. So one elevator could not take you the entire length, you know, upward and downward of the building because it was just too large.
That's crazy.
And an elevator couldn't support that, which is just...
Yeah, that's wild.
It's like, wow, I mean, that does make sense, but it is fascinating.
Yeah.
So Brian, being on the 84th floor, was above the impact zone. And remember what I mentioned, that most people who were above the impact zone did not survive.
Right.
Brian's office faced west, and he stated that he got there about 7:15 that morning. That's pretty darn early.
It's early.
Yeah. When the North Tower was hit, Brian was actually at his desk typing. He said that he felt some kind of shudder and that the light flickered. He saw flames from the window and thought it was a welding accident. Said, honestly, he really didn't think much of it. He didn't certainly think that it was a plane.
I mean, who would?
Exactly.
That's crazy.
No one. And Brian had lived through and been working in the building during the 1993 attacks. Mm, mm-hmm. And because of that, he, on his floor, was the volunteer fire marshal for his floor.
Oh, God bless Brian.
Yes. So Brian had a whistle and he had a flashlight. He had the safety vest. That's right. Man. So he told everyone To go into the corridor and wait, because that was the protocol.
Right.
Fortunately, 200 of the people were like, I'm not waiting. And so they just left, which he stated was a blessing.
Yeah.
50 people, however, stayed and listened to what he was saying. He went to the windows that face north to observe the fire and heard his colleagues saying, people are jumping. He said that he quickly backed away from the windows because he just didn't want that in his memory.
Yeah.
I can understand. Brian quickly called his family, just telling them, you know, hey, I'm okay. And he heard over the loudspeaker where they were advising your building, your office building is safe. Please return to your offices. You know, it's secure. There's something going on in the other building, but your office is secure. Please go back. Brian heads back to his office and is talking to one of his colleagues. At 9:03, the right wing of Flight 175 goes straight through the east side of the 84th floor. Brian, who just so happened to be on the west side, states that the room fell apart. It filled with white, chalky air. Brian said that for 10 seconds, he felt real, true fear.
Which I don't think is something most people ever feel in their lives, which is good.
Yeah.
But I can't ever, I mean, I've been scared in my life and like been in situations where I was fearful. But I can't imagine that level of just absolute terror.
The absolute, yes, the intensity of it.
And you wonder, like, at that point, that's really fight or flight.
For sure.
I mean, you're going to figure out what you're made of real fast.
And what's neat throughout the story is this common theme. And I do want to state, you know, whatever your belief system is totally, we respect that and is totally your own. But what's interesting about this story is for Brian, his fate always seemed to be that he was going to survive. And not necessarily, even from what he said of his own accord, that it wasn't all his doing.
Yeah.
So, as the story unfolds, you'll hear more. He states that the building swayed. He said he felt it sway several inches to the right and then come back and stabilize. He quickly grabbed the flashlight that he had put in his pocket, and he led six co-workers into the hallway. He headed towards stairwell C, which was his typical, but as he was walking towards stairwell C, he felt this strange push on his shoulder. So he turns around, like pushing him towards stairwell A. And he kind of turns around and nobody's there. But nonetheless, here he is in front of stairwell A. So he thinks, well, okay, sure, we'll take this one. He started walking. And at the 81st floor, a woman coming up the stairs stops them. She tells them all, there are flames, you don't want to keep going down, it could be dangerous, we're just going to head back up, she and another fellow.
Nope, I'm going down.
Well, everybody's like, well, what do we do? I mean, if there's flames up, there's flames down, like, we got to get out of here. Suddenly, as everybody's debating on what to do, they hear a banging noise. And Brian sort of tunes in to, what is this banging noise on the 81st floor? And he listens and he hears someone screaming saying, I'm buried, I need help. Can someone help me, help me, help me? So Brian and his coworker pull back the drywall and move towards the voice. Brian's other colleagues decide it's not worth going down. There's flames. We're going to go back up. They all died that day.
Oh my God. I don't know what my instinct would be in the moment, but I immediately was like, nope, you got to go down. You got to go down.
I would get out. But you know.
There's nowhere else. I mean, you're going to die if you stay up there. You're probably going to die if you go down. So, I mean.
But you know, I think some of the mindset is that it's okay. Help will come. Help's going to come to us. True. We have to stay in place. Help's going to come. Because part of the 93 bombing was that protocol of you stay in place and help will come for you. So There is that thought.
And nobody thought the thing was going to fall.
Nobody thought that.
Yeah, it's true.
So as smoke was swirling in the room, Brian's coworker was absolutely overcome by the smoke. And he says, no, I've got to go back out. So he goes back out and he goes back upstairs. That was the last time he saw him. Brian, for some reason, found a pocket of fresh air. And Brian kept moving towards the voice. Suddenly, and Brian states, I couldn't see anything. It was like total blackness. And he said, suddenly, I see this hand moving in front of me. And Brian says, you know, I grabbed at the hand and the voice said, hallelujah, I've been saved. And the man was stuck behind a wall. So Brian had to move things and help him kind of climb over this wall. And when the individual climbed over the wall, he actually fell on top of Brian. And the man, so grateful, kissed Brian, who was really taken aback.
I would imagine.
Absolutely. And Brian quickly introduced himself and said, hi, I'm Brian.
Hello, nice and to meet you on this very chaotic situation.
Exactly. Hi, how are you? And the man introduced himself and said, I'm Stanley. We're going to be brothers for life.
I mean, yeah, you saved my life. Like, I think that makes us.
Absolutely, yeah, brothers for life. And Brian said that he had a gash, that Stanley had a gash on his hand, and that Brian had a gash on his other hand. So he put their hands together, and they were blood brothers, which I just thought was really, really beautiful.
Yes.
And he says, yes, we will be blood brothers for life. I know. So a little about Stanley. Stanley worked on the 81st floor for Fuji Bank. When the tower was struck, Stanley and a lot of his coworkers actually went to the elevator and went all the way to the ground floor. But they were told by security to go back up to their offices.
Oh my God.
Now, this is when the North Tower was hit.
Right, so they were like, your office is a safe place.
Yes, your office is safe. Remember that announcement came over? Yes, it's not safe outside. There's debris. Things are falling. You need to go back up to your office. So Stanley and all of his coworkers went back up.
And it's like, you're so frustrated hearing these stories, but like hindsight is
completely 20/20.
I mean, there's no way that anybody could have even.
Nobody would have known. They were just doing what they were told to do. You know, they thought that was right. There's really no one to blame.
And most times, that is like,
it's a protocol.
It's like what you should do.
To keep people safe. Exactly.
Like, if there's a massive event happening outside, you don't need to go outside. You need to stay where you are.
Right.
The whole, like, shelter in place is
legit. And it's like, you know, the ones bucking the system, you're taking a risk. You're either going to be hurt or you're going to be safe. I mean, you know, you just never know in these scenarios. So Stanley goes back up to his office and his phone is ringing. So he answers it and it's a colleague from Chicago who says, you have got to get out of that building.
Stanley's like, I was just downstairs.
I know. He's like, what the heck? I just was trying to. And she tells him that the North Tower was hit by a plane because, again, you know, where they are, they can't really see. They don't really know. And they didn't hear it exactly, so they don't know what's going on. Well, they heard it, but they didn't see it.
Right, right.
So at that moment, as Stanley was having this conversation on the phone, that's when the plane hits the South Tower.
Oh, my God. Can you imagine the person on the other line with him that's, like, saying, yo, buddy Stanley, you got to get out, and then watches as a plane crashes into his floor. Like, what?
And what does she think? She's probably thinking, oh, my God, he's dead.
Yeah.
And at this point, and remember, he's on the 81st floor. He is in the impact zone as well.
That's insane.
He hides underneath his desk.
Same, Stanley. I'm there with you, man.
Absolutely. And the intensity of the noise was deafening, literally. He was temporarily deaf.
Jeez.
Couldn't hear a thing. It was, the whole room was filled with smoke and fire. And he started moving through the debris, trying to get towards the hallway. He was very close, but he got stuck behind a wall and other debris and could not move past it. He saw a light suddenly, turned out to be Brian's flashlight.
Oh, Brian.
And he began yelling for help. He really could see very little because, like I said, ash and smoke everywhere. Mm-hmm. But he saw the light coming towards him. And that's when he put his hand out. And he felt like he had been saved. He thought Brian was an angel.
Hmm.
Brian and Stanley, once together, decided we need to keep moving. They moved through smoke and water. They decided we're going to go down. I know that lady said that there was fire, but I think we need to go down. And it's so good that they trusted those instincts. By an absolute miracle, they were led the entire way by fresh air.
That's crazy.
By the time they reached the 74th floor, conditions had improved, and they just continued down to the 68th floor, and they were moving at a pretty rapid pace. They were making some time. Brian saw a colleague who was coming up the stairs, 32-year-old Jose, walking, carrying a walkie-talkie, saying, "Hey, I just was over the walkie-talkie, and I heard one of our colleagues, they're up there, they're upstairs, you know, maybe I can see if I can go up there and help him." That was the last time he ever saw Jose.
Oh, Jose.
Who passed that day.
Oh, my God.
Brian told Jose, you know, "Hey, you know, I think we're just going to keep on going down because Stanley here, he's got some injuries and I need to go and make sure he gets help first. And then, you know, maybe I'll come back up. So I'm just going to take him down." So as Jose went up, they continued down. When they reached the 44th floor, they found a security guard who was trying to help a man who had severe injuries, head injuries, had looked like he had been burned. And the security guard said, "You know, I'm going to stay here with him. You know, do you guys have a phone?" And they said, "No, we don't have a phone." And none of the phones in that building were working, obviously. Right. So he told them, "Listen, you know, as soon as you make it to the ground floor, tell them we need medics up on the 44th floor to help this man." They agreed that they would call the medics when they reached the bottom floor. When they got to the 31st floor, which is where Brian used to work, they stopped because they were making some pretty good time, and they went to a conference room and found a phone. And again, by an absolute miracle, they got a dial tone.
Wow.
Brian calls his wife, who by this point is in absolute panic because she's pretty sure he's dead.
Yeah, thinks he's probably dead.
And she is overwhelmed to hear that he is okay, he's alive. And based on the 93 bombing, she realizes that at the 31st floor, it's probably going to take about 2 hours for him to get out of the building.
Yeah.
Because in 93, it was kind of slow moving down those stairs. It was, you know, kind of one step, slow. So she had calculated, okay, in 2 hours, and kind of told her family he'll probably be home. Stanley tried to call his wife. He ended up having to leave a message. And then Brian ended up calling 911 and was transferred several times, but told them, "Hey, there's a man on the 44th floor and he needs help." Brian and Stanley continue to the main level. When they get there, they get to the shopping area. And they were kind of casually instructed by a female security guard, like, "Hey, you know, you may not want to go this way. You may want to try go this way." And they actually ran into a firefighter who told them, "There's a lot of debris. So if you're going to go, you need to run."
Oh, my God.
Because you could be hit by falling debris. And, of course, the fireman didn't mention you could be hit by a person falling.
Yeah.
But there was a lot of smoke. There was a lot of debris. And he advised them, "Whatever you do, don't look up. Just run. Just don't look up."
Oh, my God.
So they ran. They together just ran as fast as they could. And finally, they ran out of steam after about a block and a half. So they ran right in front of a delicatessen. And they asked the owner, you know, "Whew, you got any water, you know, that we could have?" Not only did he bring him water, he brought them like a lovely food platter.
Oh my God.
Like lovely breakfast food. And so Brian held onto this platter and they kind of kept on moving. They ended up in front of a church and noticed two priests standing outside.
Oh, the priests.
Yes. So they all pray together, and Stanley proclaimed to the priest, "This is Brian. He saved my life."
Oh.
Stanley. So they move forward towards Trinity Church when Stanley, for some reason, turns around and looks back at the building that they just ran from, and he says to Brian, "You know, I think that could come down." And Brian is like, "There is no way. That thing is made of steel. It's not going anywhere." And before he could finish his sentence, the building collapsed.
Jeez.
As they watched.
And that building pancaked.
It did.
Like floors.
One by one.
I've seen all this. I didn't watch it in real time, obviously.
I would hope not.
No. But watching the footage of it later in life and just seeing the way, because I think in my mind, like growing up hearing about it, like I'd never watched it fall
right
on any of those. I kind of just imagined that it fell like to the side, and so I was always very confused about like how was there not more damage,
because
right. This big building just fell down, but it
imploded.
It pancaked.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just all the way down.
Floor by floor by floor. Quickly.
Which changed the way they build buildings.
Yes.
Like significantly.
Definitely.
Changed.
Definitely. Well, and Brian states that a wave of white just starts coming towards them. But another blessing was that because they were standing behind the church, the way the church was protected them from all the smoke.
Mm-hmm.
And all the white, it hit the back of the church wall and went upward, which gave them time to start running again.
Yeah.
And he says that they ran towards Broadway with Brian. And he always says in the interviews that I've seen that your mind does weird things when you're panicked.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "I was still holding that platter." Running.
Put that breakfast platter down, Brian.
Running.
You don't need it anymore.
With the breakfast platter. And for some reason, just still had it in his hands. When he ended up getting to a safe space, he joined about 25 other people.
Yeah.
And he said at that moment, he realized why he was still holding the platter. Because he was able to feed all those people.
Oh.
Yep.
So everybody got a snack.
Who were in need. Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
They were hungry, thirsty, all
and
these things.
You know, you're panicked, you eat.
Absolutely. Oh my gosh.
And
trust
breakfast
me.
Food.
Oh, it's my favorite. So Stanley, in that moment, gave Brian his business card. He apparently had a side business, and so it had on there his address and phone number. And Brian said, "Oh, cool, thanks." They talked a little bit, and Brian put it in his pocket. So once they were able to go back outside again, once the, you know, somewhat of the dust had cleared, they were separated by what they described as almost like snow falling down, that it was so white,
yeah.
Like you could barely see. And they ended up getting separated and not being able to find each other. And Brian was like, "Oh my gosh, was he even real? Like, was he like an angel who saved me? Is he a figment of my imagination? Like, did he exist?" And quickly he had some clarity and thought, "Oh, the business card." So he pulls in his pocket and he looks, and there's the business card. Okay.
Stanley was real.
Stanley was real. So he didn't have to question that anymore. Brian states that as he starts moving forward, suddenly he hears, "There's a ferry going to New Jersey." Now, Brian lived in New Jersey. And he was like, "A ferry going to New Jersey? Really?" He was the last one on that ferry.
That's crazy.
He gets to New Jersey, and as soon as he gets to, I guess, the port there, he asks the person, "Hey, can I borrow your phone?" And of course, the statement was, you know, "Nobody's been able to get through. I'm sorry. You know, lines are tied up." And that was true.
Yeah.
Like, you could not get, even throughout the United States, you really couldn't get a hold of anybody. Brian was able to get a hold of his wife.
Way to go, Brian.
And again, she thought, it's going to take him 2 hours. He's on the 31st floor. It was probably 20 minutes later, by the time that tower collapsed,
she's like, he's dead.
She knew. She's like, he's dead. Oh my God. And here he is calling her saying, I'm coming home. I'm here in New Jersey.
I'm in Jersey.
And she's like, oh my God.
Okay. What?
It was crazy. So Brian got home and they had kind of a joyous reunion. They couldn't believe it. He was home by like 1:30.
That's insane.
It is just absolutely insane. And he was saying, you know, a lot of people were trapped in Manhattan for days. Yeah. They just couldn't get out. So he said that he had tried to call Stanley, but had to leave a message because Stanley that day was, you know, obviously getting treated.
Right.
Stanley was real.
Stanley was real.
But Stanley, about midnight, called him back. And so they were able to touch base and talk. And, you know, they're friends to this day. They are brothers to this day. And often when they tell the story, they tell the story together.
I love that.
So something to note is that about a week later, Brian dreamed, he was sound asleep, and he had a dream that at the foot of his bed, Jose appeared.
Oh, Jose.
And he talked to Jose and he said, Jose, Jose, you're alive. You're alive. Jose nodded and suddenly was gone.
Oh.
And he woke up and he said, in that moment, he just had this sense of peace that Jose was okay. Mm. And that all of his coworkers who died that day were okay too. And he said that's what helps him not feel that survivor's guilt.
Yeah.
So, as I mentioned, Stanley and Brian still friends to this day. And Brian, they both say there are so many reasons why neither of them should have survived that day. Every reason said they shouldn't have. But for some reason, they did. And this is one of the many stories that I love from 9/11. But I like this story because they were helping each other. They helped others. And for some reason, they were just supposed to live that day.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're out there and you're listening to this and you survived that day and you're still experiencing that guilt, you know that there's a reason. There's a reason that you're still here. There's a purpose. And I mean, it's true of all of us. We never know what our fate's going to be when we walk out that door. Tomorrow may be my day. Tomorrow may be your day. We just don't know. You know, but every day that we live here is precious, so enjoy the moments that we have. And that's something that Brian was really talking about, too, in the one of the interviews that I saw with him, was just each day is precious. Just love your family, love your friends, and live it to the fullest. So that is one of the many 9/11 stories, and that's the one that I chose to tell. And again, there are so many out there. And maybe every year we can tell a 9/11 story. But on the 20th anniversary, because this is very real. This is very, you know, personal to me, not because I was there, but because I remember the world before and now I know the world after and I experienced that day.
And at a really, like, crucial developmental age,
right?
As well,
like almost a grown-up, I thought I knew the world. Yeah. And I thought I knew people.
Like, you've got enough experience to where you're like, I know how the world kind of works. And then it was turned upside down very quickly.
Absolutely. It made you question everything.
Yeah.
But the one thing, like I said, that gave me so much hope is learning that most people are good. And that, yes, we tell true crime stories and we tell you about the bad. But I wanted for this story because it was such a significant part of our history and it's such a significant trauma for so many people. I wanted to share a story of positivity. And I feel like this is definitely one. So.
And definitely worth going out of the mountains for.
Absolutely.
100%.
Thank you. So, as I mentioned, to the victims, their families, their friends, we're thinking about you. We love you on the 20th anniversary. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.
See you next week.
Bye.
Bye.